Hey guys, welcome to Throwback Thursdays, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Some of you know, some of you may not know, I've been doing this for about 11 years, so I have a lot of backlogged episodes. And each Thursday, I'm going to re-release an old episode. It's a nice way to look back at things, maybe learn something you missed or relearn something. So I'm going to pick my favorite episodes, and I'm going to re-air them every Thursday on Throwback Thursdays. So check it out. It's brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. Thanks.
Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about coos deer with a longtime friend of mine and somebody you've probably heard about if you know anything about Arizona hunting and big coos deer and big mule deer. You've heard of Dwayne Adams. And so we're going to pick his brain a little bit about coos deer. What's going on, Dwayne?
It's good to talk to you and glad to be here visiting with you. You've turned out to be a tremendous asset to our industry, John.
Well, thank you. It means a lot coming from you. So a little background, Dwayne kind of took me underneath his wing almost 15 years ago, kind of taught me how to glass and be a better spot and stalk hunter. I was coming more from a whitetail standpoint, and you know, I didn't have the same Western skills that I have now. But yeah, Dwayne was an integral part in that. So,
well, you were a good student. That's a
Thank
fact.
You.
I was impressed with your stalking ability right away, and I realized right away you had a lot of potential, especially coming from the East. Most people don't have that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. So I brought you on today. You heard in the intro that talk a little bit about coos deer. We're trying to do some, talk about late season archery hunts. There's a lot of opportunity here in Arizona for over the counter and stuff like that. So we're trying to hit a lot of these over the counter late season hunts for the listeners, so they can see what kind of opportunities they have to hunt in the late season. Just give me a little, before we roll into this, why don't you give everybody a little rundown about yourself, just in case they've been living underneath a rock and don't know who you are.
I've been guiding for 38 years, and I was one of the original people that come out with the glassing with a tripod. The first guy that did that was a gentleman out of Tucson, and I picked up from that. And then since then, I've been teaching people how to glass with a tripod and binoculars and have figured out how to kill big bucks on public land. And I really try to stress that in my glassing lessons when I give them, is that when you learn how to do this, it changes the whole game of hunting, and you can have fun with your kids, your wife, and you don't have to hurt yourself. And it makes a tremendous fun out there glassing for big bucks.
Absolutely. So what are some of the things that you do now? I'm sure now it's a little different because you've been hunting everywhere in the state for so many years, but what are some of the things that you do to choose a hunting spot? Like, what are you looking for big coos country?
Well, I think big coos country, it has two things, John. I think you either have to go high or they survive, or you have to go low. I think that the middle zones are hunted so hard with the rifle hunters that the deer don't have a chance to survive there. And we're finding the great big bucks in both places, either up high where people don't look or down low where they don't look. Either of those places, and then when I say low, I'm talking the desert, really low in the desert where most people drive through. But, man, there's some gigantic bucks down there.
You know, I've noticed that, especially in the last, 5 years, that, you know, I'll be looking up on the mountain and I'll see some bucks or whatever. And then I'll be like, oh, okay, let me turn and look and see if there's any mule deer out there in the rollers. And on those rolling hills below the mountain, sure enough, 115-inch coos buck, you know, chasing a doe. Yeah, I've seen that a lot lately.
It's interesting you say that, because here in San Manuel where I live, I grew up here all my life. I'll be 63 at Saturday, and there are coos deer literally around my town now. Mm-hmm. And 5 or 10 years ago, they weren't here, but you can leave town within a mile and see coos deer now.
Right. That's crazy. I know I've heard a lot of people have been saying that. I've started to see them a little bit more and more closer to like the agriculture stuff. Like I used to, there's a place in Aravaca that has hay fields, and I would sit there and wait and see if I could see one deer come past. Never see it. Now you drive past, there's deer out in that field.
Right. I know exactly where the field is. You're right.
It's like, you know, I don't know what changed, but they're definitely adapting or evolving to a different, you know, but I think the population's been growing quite a bit. So it might just be, you know, a disbursement thing, like where they just need to move, otherwise they're too close to each other to survive. Cause they need, you know, our habitat's not good enough for them to have that many, you know, that high of a density in one spot.
Could be that. But I know that the San Pedro River right here from all the way from Sierra Vista all the way down to Hayden has coos deer now.
Yeah.
And they're all over the bottom of that thing. And there never used to be coos deer there.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. I saw them. So on the San Pedro, I guess it would be out of St. David, I think maybe.
Yes, that's correct.
I remember going in there with a buddy of mine and seeing a bunch of coos deer in there. And I was like, oh, okay, crap. They're all the way down here. And I'm like, yeah.
Well, and they're all the way to San Manuel now and below me here and all the way to Mammoth and all the way to Hayden. A friend of mine lives in Hayden that guides for me, Frank Lopez, and they see them on the golf course there in Hayden now.
Wow. Unreal. Yeah, they're definitely, and they're expanding. They're getting further and further north too. I noticed, I saw my first coos deer in unit 7 this past season.
And they're in unit 1 now. We've seen them almost every year now. We'll see, me or one of the guys that work with me, we'll see coos deer in unit 1. And I've been guiding unit 1 for 38 years. In the last 7 or 8 years, we've seen, starting to see them all the time now.
Yeah, and javelina too. I noticed the javelina getting further north too. they're getting further up north. It's crazy. I mean, it's good to see. It means that you know, the population's doing well, and you know, expansion. Who knows? Maybe in 20 years, the coos deer will be in Utah.
See, that may not be too far off. You might.
Yeah.
Might be right.
Yeah. So. Well, we're talking trophy bucks now. In the rut, what are some of the things you're doing to locate these big bucks?
Well, that changes the whole perspective. John, I tell people all the time that what you're talking about here, I think Arizona has the most unique of all states that you can hunt the rut with a bow and have a chance to kill monster coos deer and monster mule deer over the counter. That's almost unheard of. And they're almost in every unit. They're gigantic coos deer. I mean, literally, I try to tell people, hunt the does first. Find where there are a greater number of does. Then after that, start going through and looking at the bucks. So if you can find 25 or 30 does, those big bucks will come from the flats, or they'll come from the top of that mountain down to them. And every year you'll see people that have seen gigantic bucks that they've never seen before during the rut. And that's what they're doing. They're chasing those does.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. Solid rut tactic for any deer, really. I mean, I tell people all the time, like, you know, if you're going to be hunting the rut and you're going to go do scouting, don't set up cameras and be upset that you're not seeing bucks. If you're seeing does, that's great. I mean, that means those bucks are going to be in there. You know?
And it's that simple. You hit it right on the head, John. I mean, it's same thing with big mule deer. It's the same thing with big mule deer on the late ripe archery hunt. And it's the same with coos deer. Don't poo-poo those does, because one of those does come in heat, and God knows what you can see with it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It only takes one, and then it starts
That's
the whole
right.
cycle. Bucks start coming in. So, I know, because I've hunted with you, your tactics as far as that late season, you know, using optics, using radios. Let's get into a little bit about that, what you do and how you do it. And then maybe we'll talk about some other little tricks and stuff that you've picked up over the years. So basically, when you show up to your hunting spot, you're going to take a guy out. What's your first thing you're doing? You're getting to a high point. You're getting to, set up to glass, and then from there you're located a buck. Where do you take it from there?
I think the best thing, John, is I tell people that if you're going to glass off of a knob, you have to be there before the sun comes up. So does that mean walk 5 minutes with a flashlight, or does that mean walk 30 minutes with a flashlight? Every place is different. But if you're walking when the sun's coming up, you're wasting critical time. So be in those positions to glass that 30 minutes you think you need to be walking, and be sitting there and be ready to go when the rodeo starts. And if you do that, I think that you're going to have a better chance to kill those monster deer. And I think that's very important. I'll tell you something else that I've learned, John, over the years, is that the coos deer love those barrel cactus tops. And there are several places that I found a lot of does. And if you'll look on those barrel cactus tops, you'll see that those things are starting to be gone. Well, The way God designed those things, and it took me a long time to figure that out, is that if you walk up there and you try to pull one of those barrel cactus tops off and it doesn't release, it has not gotten ripe yet. And that was a long time for me to figure that out. I kept watching deer, and they would move to another barrel cactus and pluck one off, and then move to another one and pluck it off. And I went over there years later. I tried to pull one of those barrel cactus tops off. It wouldn't come off. And then I realized that the deer are smarter than people. The ones that are ripe, they know that the way they pluck them off. So some of the biggest bucks that I've killed have been out in those flats where there's lots of barrel cactus tops. Mm-hmm. And I tell people, scouting, if you're driving down there and you look at these barrel cactuses and all that fruit's gone, that means there's deer there. It's real simple. So that's one of the places that you want to start scouting your areas, is looking at the food. Those barrel cactuses come off and get ripe during December and January when we're hunting with a bow.
Right, right. So you've located some deer. Basically, you're going to send the hunter out. And what are you trying to do to get this guy into position? When you're talking them into place and basically trying to get them into position to make a shot.
Well, what I've learned is that there's only two ways to do it. You either got to tack fast and try to cut them off, or sneak up on them while they're standing up. And once they lay down, then the whole game changes, which you know by hunting with me. When they lay down, then you have to have the wind correct. And you got to move so slow coming into those deer. And if you don't, you're just going to run them away. And that's, I think that one thing that I'd like to stress, you have to have two people to do this thing. You have to have a friend or a guide or somebody, because once you leave the mountain and go down there, my Lord, the whole world changes. And the deer can move 50 yards or 75 yards left or right, and you can't find them.
Yeah. So you prefer to have, if you're guiding somebody in, you prefer them deer to be on their feet and feeding or nose and does around or whatever. That's your preference. That's my preference too. And I probably picked that up from you, not even thinking about that, but.
Well, John, what happens when a deer is feeding and he's chasing does around, his whole attention is not on you. Right. When they lay down, then the attention is on any kind of predators coming, including lions, coyotes, people. They hear every noise. And then, man, it's harder to kill those deer when they do that. And the other thing is when a deer is laying down, you don't have a good shot. There's always something in the way. So I try to, you know, everybody wants to lay them down. And once you do that, I call it stalk and spook instead of stalk and shoot. And that's just the truth. And if they're feeding, John, you got a chance for them to walk by you, and then you got a chance to kill one.
Yeah. I mean, I've kind of developed that spot and ambush tactic over the years. You know, basically trying to figure out where they're feeding to or where the doe's taking them, and try to get in front of them and have them cross me, you know, to give me a shot. Because I never found myself sneaky enough to get into a buck that was bedded. I mean, I've killed a few that way, but never a coos deer. There's always been mule deer I've shot bedded down, but never a coos buck. So.
Well, and that's why I call it stock and spook.
Yeah. What are some tricks that you would, or some characteristic stuff about these bucks, or something that you can give an edge to a guy that was going out and said, you know, if I do this, there's a good chance that I could get a buck to come in, or I know
there's several things a guy can do, but mostly, and is it you have to learn to shoot long distances first. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably more important than all the things that we're going to talk about. I, when I take a client and you fell in that category, when I talk to you right away, you could shoot long distances. When I started talking to you, well, then it makes it easier for a guy like myself. Once I find a deer, if you think you've got to get in like back east range to shoot one of these coos deer, it's just not reality. No. You're not going to do it. The terrain is not conducive to get that close to the deer. So I turn a lot of clients away that can't shoot. And the ones that do, then if they can shoot, heck, John, we're going to be on big bucks every day. And I tell them that every day. But yeah, it's up to their shooting ability. And you realize that. I mean, when you hunted with me, we seen several nice bucks. And we were right on them every time. But if they have to have a buck that's going to be within, you know, 30 yards, I just soon not guide them.
Yeah, no, I get you. Have you ever had it? You have much success with calls or anything like that?
I have had success with calls. One of the things that I do, but you've got to realize this, and I tell the client this, and if you use a varmint call, one of two things is going to happen. He's going to run, or he's going to come to you. So we try to do the stalking first and try to get close enough so the guy can get a shot. And if he can't, then he calls and says, hey, Dwayne, such and such, such and such. And I think they busted me. And then if I see it, I said, yeah, he busted you. And it's a 50-50 thing. Take the varmint call and start trying to sound like a fawn. And sound like a fawn, not like a rabbit, like a fawn, mm-hmm. a bleeding fawn. And I try to show them how to do that. And that works sometimes, John. And sometimes if that doe comes, that buck will run over the top of you. I had a guy a few years ago, and we got this darn same situation that you're talking about. And I told him, I said, his name was Don. I said, Don, try the call. And he tried it, and the doe run right by him. The buck ran in within about 7 or 8 yards, and he shot 5 miles over its back, and it run off. He got three shots at this buck within 20 yards before it ever got away. And when I met up with him, I said, what happened, Donnie? He said, it was such a blur. He ran into, I just couldn't do it. He said, I just couldn't stay with it. And he said, I couldn't even see the pin to shoot. I just held and shot. So it works like clockwork.
Yeah, no, I've actually had a lot of success with that. I've had more success with it on mule deer than whitetail, but I found there's a very specific formula, especially for mule deer. If there's five or more does in that group, if you make a fawn sound, they're coming.
That's right.
Without a doubt, they're coming.
Without a doubt, they're coming.
But if there's less than five, and the less and less deer there are in that group, the less chance there are coming. I'm assuming it's a safety in numbers thing, or it's just like, okay, hey, the too many deer for me to account for. Which one of our fawns is bleating for us? You know, I don't know. Either way, but that seems to be the magic number. If there's five or more does, there's a good chance you can call them in with a thing. But I find if you don't have the right setup, they're going to come to a certain point and they're going to look and they're going to keep looking and looking and see where they, if they're expecting to see that fawn, you know, at a certain point. When they get to a certain point, they expect to see where that sound's coming from. And if they don't see it and you don't have the right setup, you're not going to get a shot. You're just going to get a real close look at deer. So there's a, you know, I caution people to use that because you're going to spook away a lot of game and educate a lot of deer if you're not going to do it properly. I've been wanting to release a video on how I do it and how I've been successful doing it. So kind of help people out. But at the same time, it's kind of one of my tricks that I like to keep in my pocket too.
Well, it's interesting you say that, John, because that's why I said it in the beginning of the thing. It's a 50-50 thing. And I tell them, I said, now look, it's a gigantic buck. You have a chance to run him off. So I let the hunter make the decision. I don't tell them, don't, you know, you got to do it. And a lot of times they'll do just exactly, they just run and they keep running, but there's a 50% chance that they could come to you. So yeah. I don't like using it unless I got to.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember you and I, where we were on the point and there was that one big buck. And I needed like 20 more yards to go.
Yep.
And that border patrol guy came blaring with his radio and his windows down, the radio going, and busted that buck. But I had him dead to rights. I really just needed to get around this bush and he was mine.
And I remember that he had a big kicker on one of the points. I remember that deer. That was a great deer. I remember that.
Yeah, he was a big old buck. And he was in the flats. He wasn't up on the mountain.
And, that's exactly right. And if you remember, John, he was within about 200 or 300 yards from a highway.
Yeah. 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 That was crazy. But, no, yeah, that was something else. And I know that was one of the times and I tried the call and it stopped the doe, but they never came back. They just stopped and I never got a chance to get a look at him at 100 yards. But, you know, at that point it was a little too far. So yeah. No, that was something else. I have a lot of fond memories of hunting with you those couple of years back then, including that one big buck that I ended up shooting and hitting low in the leg that I, to this day, it's been burned in my skull that, you know, and I replay it all over and over and over because I remember sitting there for an hour and a half with jumping Choya in my thigh because of where I crawled into to get to make the shot. Yeah. And, and then, not getting that second shot off. I should have just tried to stick another one in him, but I don't know.
I remember my son, Luke, was sitting there too. If you remember that, Luke was sitting there and I kept telling Luke, I said, this guy's going to do it, Luke. I said, I mean, and then the next thing you know, you kept getting closer and getting closer. And I said, he's pulling the bow back. I said, he's going to kill it. And I remember you shooting and deer jumped. And that's what I told Luke. I said, he hit the deer. He said, you think so, Dad? I said, yeah, he jumped. And then I lost sight of you. I couldn't see what was going on. And then the whole circle that you're talking about, but he was a monster deer. That was one of those big desert mule deer that most people never get a chance at.
Yeah. 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 That was something else. But, anyhow, you know what? What's the like number one coos deer story that sticks out in your mind that like kind of had a impact on the way you hunt now?
You asked me that earlier, and I'll tell you, I kept thinking about it. But you know who Dwight Shue is?
I've heard the name, and I think I heard it from you actually.
Dwight Shue, he was on TV with a bow hunting show for a long time. He's written several books. He's an author and he's a good quality Christian man. He hunted with me several times, but I glassed a coos deer and we watched it for a long time and it laid down and he took off after it. And I was talking to him on the radios. He got within about 125 yards of this deer. And the next 30 or 40 yards took 2 hours. And I kept thinking, what in the world is he doing? What, you know, and I didn't want to talk to him back and forth. I just watched him and I learned something more from him. And I try to teach that to people now is that when he had that deer, he would look straight at it. And when the deer turned his head, he would take a half a step or not even hardly a step. And he would just shift his weight And that 30 or 40 yards that he took almost 3 hours. And that was the biggest lesson I ever learned about stalking a deer laying down. And I realized that I was stalking too fast when they laid down. And I'll tell you, I tell that story in seminars and people all the time, because I'll tell you, John, I learned more out of him doing that than all of the success stories I've ever done. And everybody thinks they're going to get away when they get close, and it's just the opposite. And he said, once that deer is laying down, you got a great chance if you got it, you can see the deer laying there. Well, the problem with coos deer, that's not the case. You generally can't see the darn deer laying there. But this buck was laying right out beside a mesquite tree in the flats, and he just closed the gap, and it was really unbelievable to see somebody with that kind of skill.
Yeah. You know, and I actually remember you telling me this story now, because I remember it vividly, because one of the things I started doing is when I was talking people in on radio and vice versa, I kept telling them, I said, tell me what he's doing with his head. Which way is he looking? Which way is his ears pointing? And that way I would know, hey, okay, I could take a step. I could go closer. I could move.
Yep.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah. So now that definitely changed the way I stalked, for sure. I remember you telling me that story. I don't know if it was the first or the second year that I hunted with you, but I want to switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about glassing in the late season versus the earlier hunts. How does that shift?
Well, it shifts again back to the does, but all the food after about 9 o'clock in the morning is all on the southeast sides of the ridges. And so we shift our whole glassing to the northwest side. And if you don't do that, you're not going to find very many deer. And they're going to rut on that northwest side almost all day. They're going to chase in that cool side, those little bowls and all that real thick stuff, almost all day. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with mule deer as it is with coos deer. The deer are going to lay on the northwest side out in the desert. And in a coos deer, you've got to get in those, I call it the angle of the dangle. You've got to have the angle, John, so that you're looking in those little bowls. And once you get those deer in the bowls like that, and he's chasing a doe all around, you got a great chance, Don, John, just to get in there and stand. And if that doe runs by you, man, business can pick up. I have a friend of mine, that killed a 134 2 years ago, right out of Oracle. I'm talking within the city limits of doing just exactly what I'm telling you. It was a doe, a hot doe. These bucks are chasing it. And it was 4 or 5 bucks chasing it. And this monster buck come walking right by him, chasing the doe, and he killed it.
Awesome. So just to clarify, looking at the sunny slope in the morning right at first light, and then switching gears to the shady side throughout the rest of the day.
That's that right. Okay. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And then early season, you're looking into the, pretty much looking into the sun all the time, always looking into the shade, because they're just trying to stay out of the heat.
I gave glassing lessons yesterday to a gentleman from Dallas, and I told him by 8 o'clock, every deer that we see will be either off those bald hills or laying down. It was actually 7:45, and we glassed 26 coos deer, and there wasn't a deer left. And I said, you see they're all gone? And he said, yeah. I said, we'll go around the other side, and we'll glass these same coos deer laying down and see them standing. So I took him around. I said, those deer come over that hill. And he said, I would have never done that, Dwayne. I said, listen, they're not going to stand out in that sun. I said, they're not going to do it. And I said, they've got a coat that can last between 10 and 20 below zero. I mean, it's brutal on those deer. So they're going to be in the shade. So we went on the northwest side, and we glassed the same deer and some of the small bucks we've seen. And it changes the whole perspective. So what I try to teach people is half of the hill is food. The other half is bed. You've got to understand which is which, or you're really just not going to find any deer.
Yeah, no, it's important. So I'm actually going to be in your neck of the woods next week. My nephew, it's his first hunt ever. And I don't know why his father put him in for a muzzleloader, first hunt ever, but he's got that muzzleloader coos deer hunt in 33.
Sure.
So I'm going to be down there. Hopefully I'm leaving Monday for South Dakota. And then when I get back from South Dakota is the day that that hunt starts. So, hopefully I'll make it out for at least one day to help him out on it, but, should be.
There's a lot of deer up there, John. There's coos deer all over up there. They've done
yeah.
it. It's just, I mean, you shouldn't have any problem all finding a nice buck for your nephew.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt it at all. I got some spots where I've hunted and over the years that have panned out for me a couple times. So hopefully we'll be able to find him in there. And actually, I'm more worried about getting him in close enough to shoot. He's good to about 200. He's good to about 200 with that muzzle loader. So he's been practicing. Hopefully I can get him within 200 to make the shot, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you'll do all right. I mean, I had an 80-year-old man 2 years ago that had the same tag that your nephew had, and I got him 3 shots, and then finally on the fourth one, he killed one.
Cool. You got a bunch of clients left for the rest of the season, or start to taper off?
No, I actually do. I have quite a few clients left, thank God. I have 4 clients left in the Kaibab, and then I have 26 coos deer clients altogether. So,
oh wow,
we'll do real well.
Yeah, good deal. Are you going to be gotten anybody during the archery season this year or no?
Oh yeah, yeah. Thank God, I'm already booked up for this year on January, and starting to book up for next year. I've already got 4 guys booked for next year on January. That's what I was telling you on the early part of the conversation here. I think it's the best hunt in the United States for over the counter. And I encourage people from all over the United States, buy a tag. And I mean, you can go to these units and have a great time.
Yep. Just not the ones that we're hunting in, right?
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah, give me a call. I'll give you a list of units to go to.
Yeah. All north of Phoenix.
No, I hunt north of Phoenix too.
That's why I sent them there, John.
I know. Those two units are already packed as heck with the guys from you know, the local guys. And now they close 21 for December. So 26M and 25M, those are just bombarded with the Phoenix people. So I don't know what Fishing Game's doing. I mean, I'm kind of happy because I got the 21 December tag, rifle tag for Muley this year. Right. I drew it. So it's nice. I'm going to be like me and 25 other guys in that whole unit have that tag and no archery hunters to deal with. But they're going to kill off all my 26M spots because everybody's going to – I mean, there's only X amount of places you can hunt because it's a city.
Sure.
You know, there's X amount of private land – public land, rather. And I think that's just going to – that's going to hurt the hell out of the herd, man. I'm kind of pissed off about it. I feel like if you're going to close 21, you better close 26 too. Because it's just, you're just taking everybody out of one unit and stick them in another. It's not really making them disperse. They're not going to be going to search, you know, further out. It's just people only have a day to hunt or whatever. They're just going to leave their house in the morning, go hunt and come back.
Right. So,
but
anyway. That's kind of overload. You're right.
Yeah. They've done that a couple times. I know they did it like several years back where they changed like unit 7 and unit 11 went to a draw in that early season deer hunts. And then it pushed everybody into 6A and 5B. And you know, there was just like a million people during archery season in those two units instead of it being a little bit more spread out over 4 units. So sure. I don't know. We'll see. Hopefully it's not something they're going to do for very long and they're just doing it to stabilize something. I don't know what their reasoning is for it, but
right.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. Well, cool. As always, it was awesome to have you on. You know, why don't you give our listeners a little information of where to find you on the internet and, you know, a little bit about your outfit. So if they want to come and learn from the best, they can come hunt with you.
Well, you can look me up on Arizona Big Game Hunting or Dwayne Adams on the internet. I have a guide school. I take one or two people every year and teach them how to find big bucks, and they come in and spend a year with us, and it's one of the most gratifying things I probably do is take a young man and teach him, take him with us for a full year, and they get to go with all the 30 guides that I got, and they learn from quality people on how to find and have a lot of fun killing big bucks. So I think the guide school is one of the best there is, John, because they get to find big bucks, and they had no clue of how to find big deer. So, but yeah, my webpage is Arizona Big Game Hunting, and you can just Google Dwayne Adams and it'll come up. And I also have written a coos deer book on how to hunt coos deer, and I've got a mule deer book on how to hunt the kaibab. So both those have a lot of literature. I tell people all the time, John, I wish that there was a Dwayne Adams out there when I was a kid, because mm-hmm. when I would talk to an outfitter, they were so hushed they wouldn't give you any advice or any kind of knowledge, and it costs so much money to drive around. And I try to help people. I think that it's like this show. This is a great tool for a guy can listen to this, or a lady, and learn a lot of things that they would never figure out. And the things that you guys are doing with this stuff, mm-hmm. I think it's great. And that's why when somebody calls, I try to bend myself backwards to try to help people get better educated.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head. There's a lot of guys out there that are just like, they don't even tell you what unit they hunt. You know, they don't want to have, and I get it. There's a lot of competition. You know, even with myself, I mean, I had my stickers and all my decals on the side of my truck, and people would follow me around to find my hunting spots. And, yeah, you know, it gets a little ridiculous, but at the same token, we're all trying to promote hunting and keep the heritage alive. And the hunting numbers have been dwindling year after year. And people that go out and try something a couple of times and they don't have any success at all, or don't have a good time, are not going to stay in hunting. They're not going to bring their kids into hunting. So it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It's very important to give people education. And I feel like if you educate people, then they're going to be hunting properly and not really interfering with your hunting so much too. That's the other side of the coin. So.
Well, I think you hit it on the head. And we all have to have everybody for votes, because the liberals will eat our lunch if we're fighting. And I try to stress that, guys, that are panic about somebody in their zone and this. If they outvote, none of us will be going to no zones. We'll be done.
Right. Exactly. Well, great.
I try to help. I try to help kids. I give free glassing lessons to kids. I give them free. I took a group a while back. There were six children. And if a father brings a child, they're all free. I don't. And when I call a kid, I'm talking 18, 19, 20 year old. I don't care. Just come and I'll give them free glassing lessons, because that's a vote for us down the road. And it's also something that you said, then they're doing it right. They're not out there doing things wrong. And they start getting excited about, once you start finding animals, they're excited.
Right. Yeah. I mean, think about when you and I were hunting and I was so close to killing that one big buck and those two dum-dums. Yep. That saw me stalking the buck. Oh, there's a guy stalking a buck. Let's go try to kill the same buck. Remember that guy?
Right.
Those two guys?
Right, sure.
Yeah, oh, I mean, man.
You know, and the ethics of some of the of people out there is enough to make you scream. But at the same time, just like you said earlier, we got to have their votes. We got to be on the same page, because one thing I've learned about the environmentalists, they're all on the same page and they don't want us out there.
Yeah. No, that's for sure. That's for sure. I know there's so much more unified as a group than hunters are. I mean, hell, we get into fights with each other about who's shooting what bow. I mean, come on.
mean, that's a fact.
My bow's better than yours. Okay, great. You're awesome. It's like, come on.
You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. I try to preach that all the time, but you know, I don't know how my preaching probably falls on deaf ears most of the time, but hopefully some of it's sinking in and people are starting to really think about their actions, you know, before they jump into stuff that they're not supposed to be doing. So, well, always a pleasure, Dwayne. I appreciate you coming on and taking the time with us. I'd like to get out and home with you again one of these years when you're not so, you know, well, I hope you're always busy, but you know, be nice to actually sit down and show you what the student has learned.
Well, I bet you've learned a lot. I'm glad you have, because I've kept up with you ever since we became friends, and I'm glad for you, John, and God bless you for your success.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you for all the things you do, and appreciate you.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye.